Well, people want to connect Egypt to everything.
Okay.
Because it is a high culture. It's a high culture that not a lot of people understand. Most people can't read the language. So it provides a opaque wall for people to try to sort of come to terms with it.
Okay.
Anytime you have an opaque subject, it is subject to these kinds of abuses.
Fascinating.
Well, and Joe Rogan, I'm sure, didn't help the cause.
Yeah. I'm sure he didn't either.
May have helped his cause, but not the cause.
Truth? What? Huh?
Ayahuasca.
Next, you'll want consistency and logic. How unreasonable.
Yeah, there's a lot of different little splintered offshoots like those that pop up, you know, mm-hmm. and we've covered several of them tonight, but yeah, these different ones that shoot out and pop up. I think you covered some recently on your YouTube channel.
Oh, I cover all sorts of stuff on my YouTube channel. You'll have to be more specific.
What's the, I think it was last week I saw a presentation, and I've watched a bunch of stuff since then, so I can't name what it was, but I remember it was really good. It was a dissection of something that was culturally in Egypt, and now I want to look it up and go over it, but we probably don't have time for that.
Okay.
What recent research have you been covering lately?
Oh, well, I have been trying to get back to doing more content. We really want to focus on that's our goal for this year, is to create more content and basically stronger content.
Okay.
So we've been a lot of what we've been doing over the last year has been focusing on increasing our production values, our how we do our editing, and we are at least trying to up our game. Mm-hmm. As far as, like, one of the things I do all the editing. Okay. I do all the editing. I do all the filming. I have no training in cinematography or video production. Okay. This has all been sort of amateur hour. Okay. As far as the production values go.
Okay.
So one of the things we have been trying to do is, because when we started this YouTube channel, we never expected it to take off. We plan for failure, not success.
Well, it's doing well.
It's doing very well for a channel that young. It's caught us off guard, because we, as I said, we were planning that, okay, 100 people will sign up for this thing. You know, they can get the benefits of the education. You know, Egypt and the Bible. Who'd be interested in that? You know, it's such a niche topic. No one will care.
Wrong.
So, you know, we don't have to put a lot of effort in production values. Just get something out there.
Well, it's coming along really nicely, and it's I like to sit back and listen to it sometimes just while I'm driving.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. We have a lot of people who do that. We find that our demographics, you know, kind of fit into sort of three sort of niches. You know, we started off doing, say, as I said last time, the short content videos, which is 10 to 20 minutes, not to exceed 20 minutes. We discuss the topic. We outline the topic, discuss the topic, and get out. Okay. We don't fill in every detail. Yeah, and then we still do that for our Monday releases. And then we do the live streams. And that was sort of the next evolution in this, is we then went to the live streams. And again, this is one of those things we had planned for failure, because we thought, well, you know, people will run out of questions in about 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and then we won't have to do these live streams anymore. Yeah, they never ran out of questions. Oh, we had originally planned it to be 1 hour. It's supposed to be 1 hour on a Friday night. Few questions, you know, where we're going now for like four, sometimes 5 hour marathon sessions. And I'm exhausted by the end of this. And I'm thinking, wait, weren't these people supposed to run out of questions like 2 years ago? It's like, so we do get people who will just like listen to those.
Okay.
You know, when they're driving, because it's like 3-4 hours. So, you know, we have that demographic who just like love listening to it. And we've, as a result too, we've also had people asking us to convert those into podcasts as well, which we have not done because we haven't found a suitable podcast vendor.
Okay.
I live in Canada, so podcasting's a little more complicated than in the United States.
Really?
I'm not. Well, there's a lot of the vendors, podcast vendors in Canada want you to pay money to podcast.
Okay.
Gotcha.
So that puts complications, especially if you're using long formats like we are.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm. So you don't, do you?
And then we got people who just view our shorts.
Okay.
We take some of those old live streams and we convert them to shorts.
Mm.
So the shorts are about a year behind the rest of it. But, you know, we convert those to shorts. We do one short or three shorts a week. And we have some viewers that just view the shorts. They don't view the mid-size and they don't view the long content.
Interesting. Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. So you're kind of hitting everyone. A little something for everyone.
Yeah. Well, the shorts are their new YouTube's TikTok.
Speaking of one of your shorts, speaking of one of them, there is one that you have. First of all, quick shout out and mentioning to Dr. Heiser, who recently passed.
Yes.
RIP, our respects and love to him and his work.
Absolutely.
Just great work. But you posted something recently in his about Genesis 1 and that it's not supported for creation out of nothing.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Well, I was asked if I agreed with Michael Heiser that Genesis 1 does not directly support ex nihilo creation, essentially a creation out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll see, say, young earth creationists commonly say that Genesis 1 is a direct support of out of nothing creation. Well, that's not explicitly in the text. And even the meaning of the word bara doesn't actually explicitly state that. Like, for example, mankind is barad.
Okay.
But we know that mankind was not made out of nothing.
Right.
He was made out of the dirt of the earth.
Yeah.
He is a creation of pre-existing matter.
Hmm.
So what we can't say from Genesis 1 is God is creating things ex nihilo. That's reading something into the text that's not in that text. Now, it might be in other places in the Bible. Okay? But it's not in Genesis 1.
Right.
Okay, it's not in Genesis 1.
It does make sense because it says that his spirit was hovering over the water.
Over the face of the deep, yes.
Yeah.
Over the waters.
Yeah.
But what we can say about Genesis 1 is it is definitely affirming creation by fiat, which is God speaks it and it happens.
Okay.
That so makes it's sense. It's not affirming creation ex nihilo, but it is confirming creation by fiat.
Okay.
With existing matter.
Yeah.
Yes, some maybe not, but it doesn't say. In some cases, it does say.
Okay.
You know, with the case of the creation of mankind, it does say. In the other cases, it doesn't.
Okay.
So we have to be careful not to read too much into it.
Yeah.
Read it in its context. Read it for its intended readership.
Mm.
And exegete what is actually in the text. This is responsible biblical readership.
Yeah. No, that's excellent.
Very, very good.
Yeah.
Wow. That's not evangelical. I'm evangelical. I could throw my guys under the bus. It could be.
Could be.
Very good. So we're talking about different Egyptian mythos that are in the Bible. Which parts of the Bible do you think are the most influenced through Egyptian culture?
Well, Egypt had more influence on Israel than any other nation.
Okay.
Bar none. Okay. It's the most influential culture to the Israelites of any society of or any foreign nation. Okay. It's more influential than the Babylonians. It's more influential than the Persians. It's more influential than the Moabites, the Edomites, or the Ammonites, or even the Philistines. Mm. It's mentioned over 550 times in the Bible.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's more than twice as much as the next leading nation.
Fascinating.
And it all stems back to that seminal moment of God leading the people out of the land of Egypt. As you see this over and over and over again, am I not the Lord your God that brought you out of the land of slavery, out of the bondage of servitude, with a strong hand and a mighty arm?
Very good.
It's all pointing back to the Exodus moment.
Mm.
Now, you also get other interactions with Egypt throughout the Bible, too. You have Abraham sojourning to Egypt and encountering the king of Egypt there. You have, say, Shoshank the First, basically invading the land of Israel during the divided monarchy.
Hmm.
You have Taharqa doing invasion of Israel. You have Hopre, who the kings of Israel try to ask to come and help them against the kings of Mesopotamia.
Okay.
You have Jesus fleeing to the land of Egypt to escape Herod.
Yes. Yeah. I was always intrigued by that.
Egypt is interwoven into the biblical text. So there's going to be influence. Again, nobody denies this.
Yeah.
At least nobody should. It doesn't prevent them to, but yeah, it's interwoven in the text.
Okay. Fascinating.
But there is a difference between interaction, you know, and say copying. There is a difference.
Yeah.
What text critics will call intertextuality. It's where you take the ideas of another culture and you engage them. Literature people say there's no text without intertextuality.
Okay.
I'm fond of saying it's like when you write a book. It's like when you write a book. If you have no citations in your book is disconnected from reality. Mm. It has no basis in reality. If you have one citation in your book, that's called plagiarism. Yeah. If you have 500 sources in your book, that's masterful research.
Yeah.
Mm.
The Bible is having intertextuality with many sources.
Okay.
Yep. Many sources. Egyptian sources, Canaanite sources, Mesopotamian sources, Zoroastrian sources, Hellenistic sources.
That makes a lot of sense.
The Apostle Paul is referencing Epimenides.
Yes. At the Areopagus.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
There's you have the Old Testament, as I said, the psalmist, you know, referencing, say, the hymn of the Aten. We got another section that's referencing the instruction of Anomote. There's all these different intertextual sources that go into the Bible. You have the Canoom myth. You have the Ray myth being referenced in Genesis 1, not directly, but through intertextuality. You have, say, even Mesopotamian sources like Enuma Elish, Enki and the Magic Ho. You know, these are other Mesopotamian sources. You know, Gilgamesh is even, there's some intertextuality with Gilgamesh.
Right.
It's not a copy, though.
Yeah, there's...
They're not copying syntax or, say, diction. They're not, they don't have a copy of Gilgamesh right beside them and then copying that verbatim.
Yeah.
They're engaging the ideas presented by that.
Okay.
And they'll say, yeah, thumbs up to some, thumbs down to others.
Yeah, I've heard that...
That's how intertextuality works.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard that Nimrod might be a subtle reference to Gilgamesh.
We don't know exactly where Nimrod comes from. That's one of those things that's still highly debated and highly contested. Hmm. And I haven't come down to any opinion on this because I haven't looked into the matter close enough.
Okay, sweet.
Way to go, Aaron.
Well, you know, I like reading into things that are vague.
I've often heard too, you know, speaking about the influence of Egyptian culture on Christianity and, you know, especially our modern day Christianity, but like even in our politics today, they say that a lot of our architecture in Washington has Egyptian influence and the way things were laid out, designed, and all of that. Is there any truth to that?
Well, the Washington Monument.
Mm-hmm.
It's based upon an obelisk. But also, though, that Washington Monument is sort of basically extrapolated from what they saw as being the classics in Rome. Mm. Now, you go to Rome, there's several obelisks there. Okay. Many of, say, the American founding fathers were familiar with Italy and what was there. They're not going to Karnak and seeing basically obelisks lying on the ground. Because by the time the American revolution took place, you know, almost all the obelisks in Egypt were lying on their sides.
Yeah.
Okay, they weren't standing up. They'd all fallen down. The only standing obelisks were actually in Europe.
Okay.
So you had say Napoleon, the one that Napoleon took, okay, and you had the ones in Italy. There's one obelisk from Egypt in the Vatican.
Okay.
So these were seen as basically being symbols of imperial power. Mm. Now they didn't have that symbolism in Egypt. They didn't take on that significance until the Romans started importing them in from Egypt.
Mm. Okay. Interesting.
They were essentially totems to the sun god. Think of it this way. They kind of acted like a giant sundial.
Nice.
That's really what they were. They acted like giant sundials. Now, they weren't telling time with them, but what they were doing was basically casting a huge shadow over a temple complex.
Okay. Makes sense, because it was Aristarchus who figured out through shadows that the Earth was round initially.
Oh, yeah, the Greeks already knew the Earth was round.
Yeah.
And even estimated its size within 10%.
Wow.
All by basic mathematics.
Yeah. Yeah, as I recall, I think it was Aristarchus was the first one, and then it piled in after that. I think after that it was Aristides after that? Yeah.
And Pythagoras did not invent the Pythagorean theorem. It actually predates him by 900 years.
Really?
Well, there's a tablet from Mesopotamia that has the Pythagorean theorem on it, and it dates to 900 years before Pythagoras.
Good Lord.
Whoops. Spoiler alert.
So plagiarist?
Hey, the Greeks had this philosophy. I say it, it's mine. This is how intellectual property worked back then.
Mm.
People didn't quote their sources.
Up Ouch. For grabs.
Hey, you say it, it's mine.
Yep.
Ouch. Yeah. They got
plagiarism is a modern concept.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, I mean, there are people who, there was some like 10th century trials over copies. Like the, there was this big kerfuffle from a monastery where this monastery had this beautifully illuminated manuscript, and this monk from another monastery wanted a copy of it. So he went over, made the copy, and then went back to his monastery with the copy. Well, the first monastery protested because this was a cash grab for them. You know, people came to see this manuscript. If there's a copy over there, well, they might go over to that monastery instead. So they took it to the king, and it's the first copyright case. And the king basically said, well, just like a son belongs to the father, the manuscript belongs to the original. So the other monastery had to forfeit that manuscript.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Oops. But that's like 10th century. That's like 10th century AD. So it's compared to ancient history, it's quite modern.
It's true. Yeah, there's definitely some ground to be covered on those ideas. I mean, even the early Shakespeare plays played heavily on other people's material.
Oh, it did. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is also might be why you don't hear it quoted a lot, because the early plays are like never used.
Well, it was hard to emulate the bard.
Like his later plays are all the ones that people know and memorize and use. Mm-hmm. But like his first several plays weren't stellar.
No, they weren't.
Yeah, but progressively got better and better.
Well, you know, you find this even in, say, Hellenistic literature. You know, some of the early Greek comedies were hysterically funny. Guys like Aristophanes, just hysterically funny. Then you get to like the Latin comedians, and it's awful, not funny. Guys like Plautus, it's just like, oh, this is a comedy? This is insufferable. I mean, Plautus even apologizes at the beginning of his play for not being as good as other playwrights. And this was like, how did this thing survive history?
That's pretty bad.
Right?
I can't imagine a comedian doing that today. Right. Hey, guys, you're not going to like my material, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, we, like, for example, Sappho of Lesbos, who was a Greek poet, some of her work had survived history and made it to the modern times, but they also found on some of her lost poems when they did the papyri at Oxyrhynchus. Oxyrhynchus is a big garbage dump in Egypt. But it's a garbage dump that also had a lot of mummified crocodiles.
Oh, wow.
And what they did was they would mummify crocodiles using scraps of papyrus, which is what's called cartonnage. So you're basically making a mummy out of this papyrus and paper mache. But researchers have been able to unwrap these crocodiles and have found lost texts. Two million texts in these papyrus.
Wow.
This is how we have our knowledge of, say, Koine Greek today, is from that garbage dump of crocodile mummies.
Wow.
But we've also among those papyri have found lost poems of Sappho of Lesbos. And they're awful.
Mm.
The ones that survived were the good ones.
That makes a lot of sense.
That's a lot of work to undo that and then realize, man, this is crap.
Right. It's kind of like hymns. Mm. It's like hymns.
Yeah.
What hymns do we remember? We remember the good ones.
It's true.
We remember Amazing Grace, yep. You know, How Great Thou Art, you know, great, great hymns.
Yeah.
We're not so keen to remember Fountain of Blood.
Yeah. Wonder why.
Sounds like a horror movie.
Well, I was at a church where I heard this hymn, and it left an indelible impression upon me. I'll be sure of that.
Yeah. Yep.
It sounded so strange to modern ears.
Yeah.
So strange.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking, are we playing Skyrim Oblivion or something like this? It's like Fountain of Blood. I mean, I know the metaphor they were driving at, but it didn't age well.
Can't we do this in a major key? That would at least lighten the mood, you know? But then they don't have the same effect, you know? I get it. Yep.
But there were hundreds, thousands of hymns written in the past 500 years.
Mm, yeah.
Most have not survived.
Yeah, for good reason.
For good reason.
Well, it's kind of funny. It reminds me of that scene from Robin Hood Men in Tights when he's like,
classic.
Well, maybe if you give me the bad news in a good way.
Oh, you want me to lie to you?
Yeah. It's a great scene.
But this is what happened in history, is the best stuff survived.
Fascinating.
And this is the real reason why, say, for example, the Library of Alexandria didn't survive. It wasn't because it was burned down.
Oh.
Huh.
By the time the Library of Alexandria was burned down, all the collection had been moved to smaller libraries already.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Because it had outgrown its space. So what they did was they broke up the collection to smaller libraries.
Okay. Huh. So it's not in the left paw of the Sphinx.
No. Not in the left paw of the Sphinx. Nothing's under the Sphinx. The idea that there's a tunnel under the Sphinx is ridiculous. V-Ray tried to excavate the Sphinx with dynamite.
Oh, no.
Yeah. In the 19th century, this is one of those black areas, periods of history we'd rather forget about. V-Ray thought, because he'd been told that, you know, there might be treasure under the Sphinx, he tried to excavate a temple with dynamite. This is why there's a big hole in the back of the head of the Sphinx.
Really?
Oh my gosh.
Because he used dynamite to blow it out.
This is the story I've never heard.
And then he tried to dig a little tunnel on the top to try to dig down. That's why you find a little metal plate behind the neck of the Sphinx, is there's a little 6-foot tunnel there.
Oh.
That he tried to bore out. But it was just like, I mean, he was digging through limestone. No tunnel. Just limestone. Because this is a solid embutment.
Huh.
Solid rock going all the way through. It's no bricks.
Interesting.
Wow. I see what you want to
do. Yeah, we can thank V-Ray for that.
You just ruined like half the movies out there.
Now there is a freaky tomb on the Giza Plateau.
Oh, okay.
There's actually a couple of interesting tombs on the Giza Plateau, but there's the one unlabeled tomb that's been sometimes called the Tomb of Osiris. It actually has a deep, deep shaft that goes down about 20 feet to a circular burial chamber at the bottom.
Oh.
Very interesting little tomb out there that was discovered about 3-4 years ago there.
Mm.
It's a huge necropolis, and it's not fully excavated.
Oh.
A lot of these necropolises aren't fully excavated.
Okay.
Just because there's not enough hands and not enough money to do it.
Well, yeah, that can't be cheap.
It's not cheap. It's cheaper to run an excavation in Egypt than, say, Israel. By a long shot, just because your money goes further.
Oh, okay.
It's very expensive to dig in Israel, which is why they have to charge people who want to dig thousands of dollars for the privilege of digging.
Oh, ouch.
Egypt has laws that sort of prevent people from the outside from coming in.
Ah.
You have to provide, if you're going to dig in Egypt, you have to provide your workers, domestic and foreign, with meals and a place to stay.
Fascinating.
You don't have to do that in Israel.
You just got to pay the government.
Well, in Israel, you have to pay the dig.
Ah.
So if you want to dig in Israel, you pay the dig, several thousand dollars to dig there, and then you pay for your own hotel, your own food.
Oh. Okay.
But the permit process is also easier in Israel if you are coming in as a foreigner to dig. In Egypt, you have to arrange anybody who's foreign could come in on the dig years in advance. It has to be part of your application paperwork.
Wow.
Huh.
So very few foreigners get the opportunity to dig in Egypt. Cool. Just because it's so much paperwork is involved.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any truth to opening a tomb and being cursed?
No. Here's the reason why. It's because tombs were semi-public.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, they were semi-public. Like, for example, in King's Valley, most of those tombs had a little chapel in front.
Oh.
It had a tiny chapel in front with a little pyramid stone on top. And if you wanted to go visit a king's tomb, you could do that. You could go there, and the antechamber was open to the public.
Really?
So you could go down to the tomb, go into the antechamber, see the biography of the king or the person, read it, celebrate their life, leave your food offerings there for the dead, and then leave. Nope. You were not allowed to go into the burial chamber. That was private.
Okay.
So the burial chamber was private. The antechamber was public.
Fascinating.
Mm.
It was meant for you to come in and leave offerings.
Huh.
To feed the dead.
Yeah, that's not the story they told on the movie The Mummy.
No, it isn't.
I was thinking Scooby-Doo. Don't
say that might be fiction. I've heard it said that it might be fiction. I'm not sure about that, though.
based on a true story.
But there was definitely carnivorous scarabs, though, right?
I've never encountered one myself, but...
You know, the ones like human flesh.
Yeah, I've never encountered one of those myself. But then again, I've never encountered a scorpion either.
Oh, okay.
I have never encountered a scorpion or a snake.
Wow.
That's very fortunate. I have encountered wild dogs, though, and they freak me out.
Okay.
Because they hunt in packs, and they're pretty bold.
Mm.
Oh.
And they're wild.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the dogs there are freaky.
Interesting.
I was doing a night photography out at Abu Simbel, which is the boundary temple of Ramses II. And I was doing some night photography. The skies at night there are just really clear. You see the Milky Way. You can get some awesome stellar photography done. And I was doing a photograph of the temple of Abu Simbel against the Milky Way background. Beautiful shot. Beautiful, beautiful shot. But I'm taking it, And there's hundreds of these wild dogs running around me in the middle of the night fighting.
Okay? Hundreds, huh?
Wow. Hundreds. The heck. My wife is giving me a dirty look right now because this is the first time she's hearing this.
Well, yeah.
But that wasn't the freakiest thing that was there on that shoot. Was I kept hearing this chirp, 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 chirp. The crocodiles.
Oh.
The crocodiles were about 10 meters away.
Really?
Oh my gosh.
And they chirp.
And they chirp.
Are they trying to attract you to mimic a different sound or?
I'm not sure what the purpose of the chirping is, but that's what it is. It's
oh, to self.
Lake Nasser has crocodiles in it.
Oh.
My lord.
And they can move inland, especially when they're young.
What could you do to protect yourself or anybody who lived over there in that situation?
Kick them hard?
Run? I mean, I can't imagine somebody trying to run pack a dog.
Well, you can't outrun the dogs.
Yeah. The alligator, you may have a chance.
the crocodiles, you have a chance.
Yeah.
Because they're probably going to stay in the water, and you just don't get too close to the edge.
Right.
Yeah. Whew. So how many digs do you have to worry about then when it comes to wild creatures?
It depends where the dig is. It really does. Mm-hmm. If it's in, as I said, if it's in, say up, past, the Aswan Dam, your biggest concerns are not going to be the wildlife, even though there's wild dogs, even though there's crocodiles, your biggest concern is going to be, say armed conflict coming over the border of Sudan.
Ah, okay.
When I was doing my photographic tour, they had that road between Abu Simbel and Aswan. It was only open a few hours a day because there wasn't a police escort that was necessary to keep that road open.
Oh.
Because at the time, Sudan was going through a very vicious civil war. Mm. And there's still insurgents in Sudan. You're only about 20 minutes from the Sudan border there.
Okay.
You're really, really close to the Sudan border.
So I've...
Now, Egypt has got military stationed up there. But should that overflow across the border, there isn't a lot they can do about it either.
Yep.
Okay.
So that's going to be your biggest problem if you have to go that far north. Or that far south, sorry. Go that far south, that's going to be your biggest problem, is insurgents. Insurgents are also going to be a problem in the Sinai and in the Western Desert.
Okay.
Where you have Muslim Brotherhood and factions of Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, so that's going to be your biggest problem in those areas. You will encounter some snakes in, say, the Nile Delta or in the Nile Valley. Again, dogs are going to be a problem. When you get down to the Delta, you might encounter, or more likely to encounter, like cobras, like the Egyptian cobra. That's not too bad. They're actually less toxic than, say, the asp, which can really make a mess of your day.
Okay.
Probably your biggest health concern in Egypt is drinking the water.
Yeah.
Don't drink the water.
That bad.
Don't go swimming.
Really?
Are they not making beer anymore?
Well, let me put it this way. As a tourist, you can get beer.
Mm-hmm.
As a tourist, you can get beer. As a tourist, you can get alcohol. If you go to a specialty shop.
Okay.
Or go to a bar. At a bar, you can get beer. To go get like hard alcohol, you actually have to go to one. There's one of two specialty shops that sell only to tourists.
Oh. Okay.
And when I was in Egypt in 2019, I went to one of these specialty shops to get a really nasty bottle of Johnny Walker Red. Oh, yuck.
Yeah.
That was disgusting.
It is. It is.
It's better than nothing, but boy, that was disgusting.
That's a big letdown if that's what you're drinking in Egypt. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was nasty. But it wasn't cheap either. Wasn't cheap either.
What did it cost there?
It was about $60.
Oh my gosh.
Oof. Yeah.
You'd pay 32 maybe here for it now today.
Yeah, it was really overpriced, but again, it's a limited supply.
Yeah.
Wow.
You can only get, you know, alcohol, hard alcohol in a very, very few licensed places in Egypt.
Huh.
Beer you can get at, say, bars.
Okay.
You have to show your passport.
Right now? Mm-hmm.
But you can get it. Get beer much more easily.
Okay.
They allow, say, Coptic people to drink beer. Huh. But everyone else is forbidden to drink beer because you are under Islamic law.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is an Islamic country. So alcohol is very, very tightly regulated.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, you know, it was in the Middle East that they created the screwdriver.
Mm-hmm.
The drink. Mm-hmm. Did you hear the story of that one?
No, I didn't hear that one.
So in the Middle East, you know, they have a lot of oil over there and a lot of oil rigs. And so they would specifically import vodka because it's clear. So they put it in water containers, 1 gallon water containers. And they bring it in, and orange juice is everywhere there. So what they would do is they would take, you know, vodka, orange juice, and then out of their tool belt, they would grab the screwdriver and stir it up. And that's how the screwdriver was created.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I'll say this about the oranges there. It's very tart.
Oh, really?
It's really tart. It's really difficult to drink because it's so acidic.
Wow.
It's very acidic.
I wonder what it is. Is it the climate, maybe?
Yeah, probably the climate. But I've noticed that with orange juice across Egypt, it is very acidic.
Huh. That's interesting. So it needs the vodka.
Needs the vodka, yeah.
Good enough reason for me.
Hey, it works for me too, yeah. Just hold the orange juice. I'll take the vodka.
Was there any drink in Egypt, you know, that like, oh man, this was worth it? It just made up for it, or
no?
No beer that you really liked, or?
Well, the beer is pretty. The local beer there is not that much different than Coors Light.
Oh wow!
Okay,
okay. It's not. They're pilsners. They're pilsners. Not a lot of character to them.
Mm.
Mm.
So I'm not a huge fan of Egyptian beers. At least the modern ones.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, does that hold true for like ancient Egyptian beer? Is that
ancient Egyptian beer is a different animal altogether. It's a different animal altogether. It also is brewed under different processes as well. Different processes, different yeasts. You're going to get a really different product. The yeast that they're going to use, the ancient Egyptians are going to use, is more akin to sourdough yeast.
Oh.
Than it is to, say, modern brewing yeast that you would find in, say, a Pilsner or even an ale sort of brewing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more akin to bread yeast than it is to, say, modern strains.
Okay.
Whereas modern Egyptian beers are using basically using normal brewing yeasts.
I hear opportunity.
I think there is one brewery who's trying to recreate this on a commercial scale.
Really?
I don't know the name of the beer, though.
Okay. That would be cool. But
it's here in America. It's not over in Egypt.
Okay. Oh. We'll have to look for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because some of the most interesting beers are the ones they created on those little offshoots.
Yeah. You
know, even Trappist breweries are very unique. You know, the way that they create their beers to get that very unique flavors to them.
Well, we also have to keep in mind, too, that what made ancient beer more distinct, too, is a lot of the contamination. in the brewing process. So a lot of flies in Egypt. And flies carry Acetobacter.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Mm. This is what takes alcohol and turns it into vinegar.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So because flies are so common in Egypt, most of the ancient beer is going to have a kind of a tart, lemony, vinegary taste.
Huh.
Because it is so heavily contaminated.
You just spoiled it all for me.
It's actually not bad.
You messed up all my preconceived notions of it.
Well, it is going to give the beer kind of a lemony flavor, the tartness.
Okay.
That you wouldn't normally have in beer.
Like a craft brew.
Yeah, kind of a craft brew.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we've had some real tart ones.
It'll have citrus notes.
That's right.
But not citrus notes from the hops, citrus notes from the Acetobacter.
Mm. Yummy. That's kind of like when they make aged beef, right? And they just grow bacteria on it so that it eats some of the beef away.
Yeah.
So it's tender aged beef.
Yeah. But these are industrial, these are food processes that are thousands of years old.
Mm.
Nobody died from them.
Yeah.
Now think about what went into cheese. Come on.
True story. My wife and I go back and forth on that because she's a huge cheese lover, and I'm like, well, which kind of bacteria do you need today? Because all those little bacteria, there's a reason why certain cheeses taste like foot fungus, because yeah, it's the same bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Oh man,
candida.
Yeah,
lactobacter candida.
Yep, that's it.
Yeah, I used to do some cheese making too.
Nice.
Yeah, so.
You're a whiskey guy, right?
I'm a whiskey guy.
Do you make your own?
Should I answer that question?
I don't know if you should. I won't get you to. Okay, so what kind of whiskey are you drinking?
Let me put it this way. I am able to make my own.
Okay.
Fair. Because I learned how to make my own when I lived in England.
Okay. Yeah.
Very cool.
So I know the whole process.
Gotcha.
And I used to experiment widely with it.
Nice.
It's safe to say that you get pretty high standards when you drink whiskey then.
Yes, my standards are pretty high. I can tell the difference between a copper pot distilled whiskey and a refractory distilled whiskey.
Mm.
It tastes really different.
Okay. Very good. I was actually up there in Calgary last year. It was stop at a nice little whiskey bar there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, it's you can get some real great variety in whiskey. Especially now. There's all sorts of different producers, and you're going to get regional differences and even manufacturing differences.
Mm-hmm.
And each, I think, has its own particular character, its own approachability, its own challenges. Flavor profiles.
Yeah.
You know, you get a Bush Mills that, you know, has, say, hints of banana flavor in it versus, say, a Lafroy, which has a very peaty taste.
Yes. Yeah. I like Lafroy.
I do too. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah. The peat, I think, is what gives that character. It's a little bit heavier too, because as you, you know, swish it, you can actually see a little bit of the oily structure inside of it.
Oh yeah, especially if you add a drop of water to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's when you really see the oil on that. The whole peating process is very interesting all by itself. And there's actually multiple ways you can peat a whiskey.
Oh.
The traditional method is to essentially mulch your grain and then put it in a smokehouse.
Okay.
With a brick of burning peat. But that's not the only way to do it.
Okay.
You can actually do it by using put a basket of burning peat inside your stripping run.
Nice.
You can do it that way too. And if you do it that way, you do your stripping run and then you do your spirit run and it comes out just about balanced right.
Mm. Awesome.
So there's more than one ways you can peat a whiskey.
Yeah. Which, and that peat was cut out of those bogs.
Oh yeah, it's peat bog. It's sphagnum peat. Yeah, it's the same stuff. And there's also going to probably be some regional differences in peat as well.
That would
because
make, yeah.
Sphagnum moss is not the same everywhere.
Okay.
There's 50 species of sphagnum moss. Distributed all differently all over the world.
Hmm.
Scottish peat is going to be very different than, say, Vancouver peat, which is going to be different than New Zealand peat.
Okay.
We're going to have whiskey next time.
Absolutely.
Well, next time I promise I'll drink whiskey with you guys.
Sounds good.
Yeah, we got to find a way that we can all drink the same thing.
Yeah. Well,
hey, send me a bottle, then we got it solved.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We could do that. What's your current running favorites?
Oh, as I say, Laphroaig is one of my own ones. I want to try some of the other Ela whiskeys too.
Okay.
So I'm eager to try some more, but I'm also right now on a I'm on a church mouse budget.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I can't really experiment widely. I like McClellan. I think McClellan's very good.
Okay.
Yeah, I got that at home.
Glenfiddich.
Yeah.
19 years.
Oh,
okay.
Not the 21.
Hmm.
Okay.
The 19 is better than the 21.
Okay.
Good to know.
One of the things I really liked, I've tried the Glenfiddich 5, 12, 19, and 21.
Okay.
The 5 was okay. The 12 is better. The 19 is a very complex whiskey with meltable layers.
Mm.
Okay. Anytime I get a drink with multiple layers of flavor, I'm in my glory at that point.
Yeah.
The 21 has been aged just 2 years too long and has actually lost its notes.
Okay.
Okay. So even though you're going to pay $250 a bottle more for the 21 year than versus the 19, it's not worth it. You're getting less.
Keep that in mind.
Also,
Glenfiddich 19.
Mm-hmm, Glenfiddich 19. Like, for example, as I say, one of the things I love in drinks is complexity. This is why I love drinking, when I could still do this, vermouth rosso.
Oh.
Basically red vermouth.
Yeah.
The way the Europeans do it.
Okay.
Which is refrigerated straight up, not as a mixer.
Really?
Most North Americans have never thought to drink sweet red vermouth as a cocktail, as a drink on its own.
No.
Try it.
Okay.
You'll get layers of sweetness, of raisin, of orange. Ooh. And it'll have even a nice pleasant aftertaste to it. It's a very complex alcohol.
Okay.
Very complex.
It's wetting my whistle already.
Hey, and we didn't even get to the various ways you can oak a whiskey. You know, there's that's one of the things I learned when I was doing whiskey was you can change the flavor profile of whiskey by changing the wood.
Very, very nice.
Because one of the things is you're gonna go if you go buy a bottle of whiskey from the store, okay? And you can actually do this at home if it's legal in your state. Okay, and I'll qualify that. As you go to the liquor store, you buy yourself some moonshine. Alcohol, vodka in a pinch. If you can't get moonshine, get vodka.
Okay.
Okay? Get a glass jar. Put your vodka or your moonshine into that glass jar. And then take a strip of toasted wood. You know, toast it in your oven for 350 degrees for about an hour.
Okay.
Okay. And you can get wood chips at like Home Depot. They use them for barbecuing. And then put that in there and watch it start to color your alcohol.
Mm.
You're making whiskey.
Okay.
Okay. At that point, you're transforming that white whiskey, moonshine, vodka into a different drink. And you can change the flavor profile of that by changing the wood.
Mm.
And you can even change it by how it's toasted. Bump that up from, say, 350 to 430, and you're going to get a different flavor profile again. But I've tried stuff like, of course, the classic white oak. But that's not my favorite. Not even close. I put like mesquite, cherrywood, applewood. Each of those was going to give you a very different flavor. The mesquite was very interesting. Very interesting. You have to be careful with the mesquite not to over oak it.
Okay.
But you can get something that tastes like a well-aged whiskey in a couple weeks.
Oh.
Because it's such a strong flavorant.
Interesting. These are things I'm going to have to try now.
I know.
But the cherrywood's really nice.
Okay.
But I've done this with whiskey. I've done this with brandy. I've even done, what was the other liqueur? I've done it with rum, brewed and distilled my own rum when I was in England. You know, you can do this with a variety of different alcohols.
Sweet. All right. Challenge accepted.
Yeah. Challenge accepted. Maybe next time we'll do that Glenfiddich.
Yeah. Might be a good one. Tell you what, for our next, when we reconnoiter with you, you let us know about one of your favorite top five. And I'm going to look for a local vendor for you so we can get you a bottle.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Look forward to that next one.
Sounds excellent.
Under $1,000, though.
right. Well, this has been a fun time. Another great podcast with you. Thank you again. I was going to say, thank you again for coming on. It's always vastly informative. You're readily able to answer all of our questions. So it's fantastic.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I have a great time when I come on here. This is a lot of fun. I really, really enjoy your podcast.
Thank you.
It's just like, I love the mix. I love the mix of beer and a Bible. You know, that's two of my favorite things. How can I not like it?
Right?
We feel the same way, man.
Right? Yeah. We try to make it like a friendly environment, like you're sitting at a tavern with a friend.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, but yeah, thank you again. Do you have any final questions or?
No, I appreciate you being on. Appreciate your work. Thank you. Looking forward to ripping apart part 3 and part 4 patterns.
Yeah, absolutely.
Over some Glenfiddich.
What he said.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah, thanks again for coming on. Look forward to having you on again.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Duncan.
Have a great night.